Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility if you'll only try. Back in 1995, I was one of millions of viewers around the world who sat down on August the 28th to watch what was being labelled as the video that would change the world. This footage was allegedly cast iron proof that the United States government was fully aware of the physical reality of aliens and UFOs and their visits to Earth. The film claimed to show the autopsy of a deceased alien cadaver which had been shot in 1947. The frenzy followed included claims of authenticity due to the period detail involved in the film, to outright fakery. Most people associate the name Ray Santilli to the film, yet he was simply the promoter for it. The creator and organiser, Spiros Melaris, was the man who built the set, created the team that built the alien, hired the actors, shot the film, and fully researched it. Now, in light of the absurd claims that this forgery is actually real, which is currently doing the rounds, Spiros joins us to explain the truth of the alien autopsy once and for all. Enjoy. Back in 1995, ufology was in the midst of a renaissance due to the explosion of interest in the field thanks to the success of the X-Files. Magazines adored the shelves of every newsagent, documentaries and books covering the phenomenon appeared on a weekly basis, and yet the biggest revelation of that year was just around the corner. The summer of 1995 saw the name of Ray Santilli hit the headlines and saw major newslets around the world broadcast an alleged alien autopsy. Within days, experts lined up to deride the film and conclusively decide it was a hoax. Today, incredibly, this film is once again back in the news, being put forward as a real event. So I am delighted to have the man behind the film, Spiros Melaris, to join us today. Spiros, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, pleasure to have you. So, 2019, and here we are, incredibly, still talking about the alien autopsy film from 1995. Did you ever expect, you know, back 24 years on, that this would rear its ugly head once again?
Paul, I didn't think it would last longer than a few weeks. I'm probably the most impressed person out of all of you, because we did it a little bit of a giggle.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing how many people will suspend their disbelief. They will ignore, you know, absolute evidence, and fill in blanks that, you know, don't exist. And it just baffles me that
I mean, it's very strange. I mean, like I referred to into the introduction there, it was in the midst of a long, hot summer. You know, ufology seemed to be everywhere at that period in the mid-90s. Everything seemed to be exploding. I know 40 and Times seemed to be going through a renaissance and sales were going through the roof. Obviously, the X-Files was up, you know, the number one TV program across the world. UFOs were big business. It was the in thing to be into at that period. And I remember hearing about this alleged film coming up. So I actually had myself and a few friends came round the night it was shown on Channel 4.
Okay.
And we were all just baffled after about 10 minutes going, really? and one of my friends that's within minutes just said, nah, I'm not having this whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'll tell you something that I haven't spoken about this before. And I'll tell you something that happened, which is quite funny.
Mm.
We made it thinking people won't know what it is and they'll play fair.
Yeah.
And they'll say, well, you know what? We don't think it's an alien, but we don't know what it is. It's not a human. We haven't got a clue.
Mm.
It's probably a special effect. And then somebody would say, I'm the leading guy in special effects. And it's not a special effect if it's dated at 1947, because we couldn't have done it in that time. And it will go round the circles and eventually be, well, we don't know what it is,
yeah.
Okay? And that's where we want it to be, okay? But my original deal with Santilli was that we would give it free to all broadcasters,
yep.
And let them discover what they like.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would make a revelation documentary, which would say, this is what it is, this is how we made it, and take a bow.
Yeah.
Well, Channel 4 didn't play fair. Okay, what they did was they got a free alien autopsy film, because Santilli did do that in England. He did give it to them free.
Mm.
He sold it everywhere else.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't where I would hear about it.
Mm.
Okay, in my home territory, I would know immediately if he'd sold it. So he did give it to Channel 4 free. And all of a sudden, you've got a special effects guy. I've forgotten his name now. Bob Keane. Yes, it was Bob Keane. At Pinewood, and he said, oh, yeah, definitely fake. And then you've got this doctor at Guy's Hospital, Dr. Ian West. Yep, it's definitely a fake. And I wasn't having any of it because they weren't playing the game. They wasn't playing fair. You know, if you're going to trash something, you need to do it properly and fairly.
Mm.
You can't just say because I feel like it, because that's not fair, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, it got my back up. And I said to the team, I'm going to make a bogus documentary, right, to go with a bogus film. So I said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to go and talk to these people. I'm going to re-interview them and show them that they're not being fair.
Yeah.
Okay. So first thing we did, we went and saw Ian West at Guy's Hospital. And he said that he felt that it was 98% man-made.
Mm.
So I'd met a voiceover artist a year before that I'd used a couple of times, a guy called Saul Reichlin, who's also an actor and a qualified barrister.
Mm.
And that's why I wanted to use him. So I said, okay, what we're going to do, Saul, is my client has bought an alien autopsy. We think it's an alien autopsy. I'm going to go and talk to people who have said they think it's fake or think it's real, and we want to find out why they said what they said.
Mm.
But I want to do it in a kind of a cross-examination style, okay?
Yeah.
So that we literally let them hang themselves.
Yeah.
Okay. So he was turned on to that. So we did a deal, and off we went with a crew and filmed everybody.
Mm.
Now, the first thing he said to Ian West, he said, well, You said on the Channel 4 program, it's almost like a right to reply.
Yeah.
You know, so you said on the Channel 4 program that in your opinion, it's 98% man-made. What did you base that on? And he said, well, you know, the way it looks and the way it feels and it's probably, you know, the probability of it being real was, you know. And he said, yeah, but you don't really know, do you? And he said, well, you know, in my experience, he said, well, your experience as a medical doctor of human beings, right?
Yep.
And he said, yes, but in my experience, tissues don't behave that way. He said, well, animal tissues or human tissues, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he basically kept painting him into a corner. And eventually he said, well, see, this is my problem. If it's 98% man-made, what's the other 2% for? And he said, well, that's in case I'm wrong. And he said, well, if you're wrong, you're 100% wrong.
Yeah.
You're not 2% wrong.
Yeah.
He says, but isn't it fairer to say this is a 50-50?
Mm.
It is or it isn't. So he's now looking up at the sky and he's biting his lip. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what to say.
Mm.
And he said, because if it's a human, right, all the experts will be saying, this is a human, and they'll be going against you, right?
Yep.
So that's their expertise.
Mm.
But your expertise is not in aliens, so you have to be fair and say, you don't actually know what this is.
Yep.
And he says, it's a 50-50. You think it isn't, but you don't know.
Mm.
And he then resigned and said, well, 100% I don't know what it is.
Mm.
Right?
Yep.
So with the right questioning, it turns everything around.
Yeah.
We then went to Bob Keane. And at the time, I was working with ATV in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to do a big documentary. And I said to them, would you put up $1 million if I could get someone to recreate this alien autopsy exactly? And the deal would be that if they recreate it exactly to the same spec,
yep,
that you would give them $1 million. And they said, yeah, we would do that. So I got the offer from them, and I called Bob Keane. I said, look, we're making a documentary about this alien autopsy. Have you seen it? Yeah, I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
We saw you on Channel 4. Do you think you could recreate it? And he said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I said, well, before you answer, you need to think about this carefully. It needs to be done exactly the same way, in total secrecy,
mm-hmm,
and on 1947 film.
Yep.
And when it's released, no one must know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be, you know, that level of secrecy. So he said, I still think I can make it.
Yeah.
So off we went, interviewed him as well. And by the end of the interview, he said, I can't make it. I didn't realise the level of detail that I had to go through. Because we had to point it all out.
Mm.
You can't just put any clock on the wall or any telephone.
Yeah.
Or, you know, everything had to be period and correct.
Mm.
And I said to him, if you can't get it, you have to make it. And, you know, and I went through the whole thing and I said to him, anyone that you employ is a loose cannon, because the News of the World would have given them £20,000 just for a single frame.
Yep.
So so he resigned that he couldn't recreate it. Therefore, who knows what it is.
Mm.
Right. And this went on for a while. And eventually everyone that said it was fake said they didn't know, and it could be real.
Mm.
The Fox program was totally different, of course.
Mm.
That was very pro it being real.
Yeah.
And it was done in a more sensationalist way.
Yep.
Was
that the one presented by Jonathan Frakes?
Yes. Fact or Fiction.
Yes.
In fact, you can still get that on Netflix right now.
Yes, you can, actually, because I remember a few months ago, strangely enough, before this all reappeared in the news, Spiros, my partner,
yeah,
who indulges my love of the strange, said, would you be, you know, I found this video on Netflix, and I said, and she sent me a picture of it, and I said, oh,
yeah,
God, I said, I haven't seen that for years.
Yeah.
And it's a strange coincidence. And I said, oh, no, it's completely fake. She went, oh, blimey neck. But about a month later, I was on the 14 Times message board.
Yes.
And somebody said, oh, I've found a trove of mid-90s UFO magazines, including one magazine called Sightings.
Oh, yeah.
And the very first edition included a VHS video recording of this film. And I thought, this is really odd. Because within about a month, this thing that I thought had been put to bed a long time ago had reappeared in my life. And I thought, this is a bit strange. And then within about 2 months, obviously, I was aware of the growing noise about this film reappearing. And I just thought, I'm not a big believer in fate, Spiros, but I'm always intrigued by coincidences. And it just seemed very peculiar that it all seemed to be popping along at the same time. So going back to obviously when it broke, as far as I'm aware, and by all means, please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
The first notification that Ray Santilli had allegedly acquired some footage came to the attention of Befora, I believe, in 93, where he'd contact them to explain that he had potentially some smoking gun revelation of an alien autopsy.
That's correct.
So the whole machination and creation of this film was set from that point onwards. Is that right?
That's right. Well, when I met Santilli, I literally sent him a fax to say, I'm going to be in Cannes with a film crew.
Yeah.
Do you need anything filmed? Because I was going out there to do one job, and it just seemed while I'm out there, there must be other people that want interviews or something party filmed or something that's out there. And I actually did a market every 3 months, that's four a year. And for those listening don't know what I'm talking about, they probably heard of the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah, yeah. A friend of mine attends it every year.
Yeah. Well, you might not have heard of MIPCOM, for example,
no.
Which is more the kind of computer games, communications, that kind of festival. It's like a big conference, if you like. And then there's another one that's called MIDEM, which is all music. It's all the record labels and all the artists and that sort of stuff. And then there's MIPTV, which is only television. And that one tends to be held other places, not just in Cannes. It could be in Hong Kong, or it could be in America. It flits around. Just to give everybody a bit of a break. But I attended all four every year forever, you know.
Yeah.
And I used to do a TV show called In the Cannes. And I used to interview people about the new projects that are coming up. So before they even hit the TV sets, or before a record was released or whatever, I had the inside scoop, if you like. I faxed Ray Santilli and I said, I'm going to be in Cannes. Do you need anything filmed? And he said, no, I don't need anything filmed, but you're very local and we should meet anyway. There'll be other projects we can work on. So I said, okay, great. So we exchanged details, and I was very impressed at the time because Santilli's mobile phone worked in France. And everyone else's didn't.
Yeah.
You know, it was that time. It was that time when everybody, you know, was a. Now I was very lucky because when I did the In the Cannes program, I was sponsored by Sony, and Sony used to give me phone handsets.
Yeah.
And I used to have to put them into the show somehow.
Yes.
So it was a fantastic interview technique. What I would do is I would be behind all the big players who are interviewing the big star. So it might be Pelé, for example, or it might be Hulk Hogan, or it might be whoever. And they would all be in front of with all the microphones pointing at them and waiting their turn to get an interview.
Yeah.
And what I would have my assistant phone the phone I was holding, and it would ring. And then I would say, hello, very loud. I'd say, oh, yes, one moment. And then I'd hand it to the celebrity and say, I'm so sorry, it's for you.
Yeah.
And they would take the phone from me. And it was one of these Star Trek-y ones. You know, it had a flip-down mouthpiece. Not the whole, that wasn't the whole thing that flipped down. It was just the microphone.
Yeah. Well, I remember those. And they were very...
it looked very modern and very high-tech, you know. And they were intrigued with this phone. And they would take it from me.
Yeah.
And then my assistant would start to interview them on the phone. We would be recording the phone conversation and I would be filming it. So instead of a microphone, they had a phone. And I used to get right in front and get the interview before everybody else. Everyone politely waited for this phone call to end. And they couldn't hear the questions, and we were just getting the scoop really quickly. So I had these phones which also worked in France. And I only elaborated on that because it was a lot of money at the time. You know, some of my phone bills were coming to £700. You know, it wasn't like it is now.
No. Absolutely. So, I mean, I had a Nokia brick, Spiros, if I wore it in a jacket, I basically looked like I was lopsided or I was, you know, severe sciatica.
Yes. I had all of those. I mean, it's just, you know, that's what you do, isn't it? I'm a bit of a gadget freak. So,
yeah,
love my toys. So when I got to France, the crew disbanded. They all went different places to eat different things. And I had an assistant at the time who was from Austria, who was a real pain. And she didn't want to eat this. She didn't want to eat that. She was very specific about what she could or couldn't eat. And we ended up in this Italian place. And we sat down, and I started talking to a gentleman across the road, across the table to me, from Warner Brothers. He was a big boffin at Warner Brothers, and we were chatting about all sorts of stuff there. Only 3 or 4 seats away from me, across me, there was Ray Santilli was sitting, but I didn't know who he was. And it wasn't until I was going to phone him, and we phoned when I arrived, and I said we'll meet up the next day, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we were in a restaurant, and at the end of the evening, the American gentleman that I was talking to says, "So how do you say your name? Is it Spiros? Spiral? How do you say?" And Ray just looked at me and said, "Spiros?" I said, "Ray?" And that's how we met. That's the first time we ever met. A complete fluke, you know, one of those coincidence moments.
Yeah.
And he then spilt the beans and told me that he had an alien autopsy film.
Yeah.
And I asked him if it was a foreign person or a real alien.
Yeah. By this time,
I'm looking at him, like, you know, I've just spent an evening speaking to him. I think, oh, no, I just wasted my time. The man's nuts, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, no, very seriously. No, I've actually got a film from the US military from 1947.
Yep.
So I thought, okay, look, I've got nothing to lose. So I said, well, so what do you need me to do? And he said, well, maybe you could log the footage and then make a documentary from it. And we can do it together. And I said, okay, let's talk when we get back. I'll have a look at the film and then we can make a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. So was this the summer of 95, Spiros?
It was January.
Right.
It was January of 95.
Yeah.
At MIDEM.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have basically called me a liar and a this and a that, and, you know, dragged my name through the mud.
Yeah.
I've still got my pass, you know, from MIDEM. It's got my face on it. It's got the barcode. It's got all the stuff, you know. And I was there, you know, and so was Santilli. You know, it's just one of those. If you don't want to believe, you believe nothing, you know.
Absolutely.
But anyway, so Santilli, when he came back, I met up with him, and he showed me what we now know as the tent footage. And that was just a piece of nonsense. Even the people that made it as a piece of nonsense. It was supposed to be a bit of a practical joke.
Yeah.
Ha ha, Ray, look, we've got an alien autopsy. Mm. And it was them all dressed up, you know, and a papier-mâché head, you know, made out of, you know, it's just nonsense.
Mm.
But Ray thought, you know what, I could sell this.
Yeah.
Only Ray, by the way, only Ray. Ray could see a deal. He could sell his grandmother, you know. that's what it was. It was just a case of he saw a quick buck. And when he showed it to me, I didn't realise, of course, that he'd already spoken before and with Phil Mantle. And no one believed he had it.
Mm.
And, of course, he hadn't had it. He didn't have it. And then when he said he did have it, and then I saw it and told him it was fake, so suddenly he hasn't got it again.
Yeah.
Because he can't show it to anybody. And he's got everyone breathing down his neck. Where's this film?
Mm.
So I'd got in the car, drove on the way home. And as I'm driving home, I phoned my very good friend, John Humphreys, who's a sculptor and a special effects guy.
Yeah.
And I said, John, and I've done quite a lot of stuff with him and worked alongside him and stuff. And I said, look, John, I said, you should have seen this film. We could have done it with our feet. And he just said, well, why don't we? Let's do it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I saw an opening. Maybe we should do it. You know, it'd be a great challenge. And the kind of brain that John's got and the way my mind works and the team, as we pull it together, we're all very good. We're good thinkers. We chew the fat, you know, and see the flaws before they happen, and go through, you know, what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and what the thinking is behind it.
Yeah.
Because whatever we do, we need to know what you're going to think when you see it.
Yeah.
If you say it's fake, which you're very likely to do, we need to give you nothing to go on. So you say, well, I don't know why. It's just a feeling.
Mm.
Doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. And that's why I was upset with Channel 4.
Yeah.
You know, we went to a lot of trouble to get to the point where we were we were happy that people would not be able to say it's a fake because of this.
Mm.
Not very soon, anyway.
Yeah.
So the rest is history, as I say. I explained to Ray that I could make it.
Yeah.
He asked me what it would cost and would it stand up to scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
And all that sort of stuff. And I said, yeah, I can make it good enough to stand up to scrutiny on every level for a while.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I don't want to break the law. I don't want to sell it and tell people it's real.
Mm.
Just like the last guy that did you. I said to him, I'm not going to play that game.
Yeah.
However, if we just give it to people and say, we've got this film, tell us what it is.
Mm.
Right. And I said to him, the only thing that we will do is we will date it for them.
Yep.
So because if we don't date it, you see, it's a fake, full stop.
Yeah.
It finishes there because there's no argument that it isn't a special effect.
Yeah.
The minute you stick a date on it, either the materials necessary and the know-how necessary was available or it wasn't.
Mm.
And if it wasn't, then it can't be a special effect. Now it's wide open to what it is.
Mm.
So 1947, I mean, Hammer House of Horror were making some really, really crappy films in the 60s.
Yep.
So if this is 47 and they could do this sophistication of special effects, why wasn't Hammer House of Horror doing it?
Yeah.
In the 60s mm. and other movies, of course.
Yeah, of course.
So it was quite easy to then say, okay, well, if we know it's 1947, the rest of it would all fall in place because everybody will say we think it's a fake.
Yeah.
It's an alien, you know, for God's sake. You know, no one's credibility is intact mm. the minute they say, I think this is real.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to say, look, in my expertise, it's not a human being, but I don't know what it is.
Mm.
Is it a special effect? The special effects guys say, in my expertise, and I've made dinosaurs, and I've done this, and I've done that. I can't do this in 1947. And there's a few things in this which baffle us how they did it. Well, that's because I'm a magician and I work in a different way.
Yeah,
they're special effects experts, and they do the magic via the lens,
mm.
right? But I could also do live magic within a piece.
Yeah.
So that will throw them because they're thinking there's a technique that makes that happen, and actually it's a magical technique.
Hmm.
So that it creates a bit more mystery.
Yes.
So long story short, we saw that the Santilli's fake film was fake, unequivocally. It wasn't even a question. It wasn't even a question because it was low band or VHS. Camera original material.
Yeah.
It was just wasn't available in 1947. It ends there.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, Spiros.
Sorry, he tried to say it was film and it was transferred to VHS, but I explained to him there were artifacts that were on the tape which come from a camera head, not from a film
yeah.
to VHS. So he now had a problem because he needed this film quickly because he told everybody he had it.
Yeah.
So we had to work quite quickly to make it.
Mm.
And he was just fielding everybody. So that's how it all started.
Yeah. So at what point, because obviously I'm aware of the alleged backstory of how he came to acquire these mysterious canisters.
Yes.
That he was apparently on a trip to Cleveland, Ohio, looking for Elvis footage because he's a big music buff, isn't he?
That's right.
So, and whilst he was there, quite how that kind of comes into the conversation, the chap that was in this shop he was looking in said, oh, well, if you're looking for something interesting, I've also got this. Was that part of the narrative from that point that you became involved, Spiros? Or had Santilli already begun to perpetuate this backstory prior to meeting yourself?
Yeah, Santilli did already use that story.
Mm.
It's now come full circle and it's come back to bite him because there's no reason why the cameraman can't be named now.
Mm.
He can't be alive.
Yeah.
So there's no reason not to name him. And the problem is that the backstory Ray embellished quite a lot of stuff. He didn't understand how to write a convincing script. Because when you're telling a lie and you embellish it with another lie. And then you tell another lie to cover that lie. And before you know it, it becomes Chinese whispers. But people then say, hold on a minute, but you said that before and now it's done this. And you get caught out, you know, which is always the reason why you shouldn't tell lies, children. Okay? Because it'll come back to bite you. So with the story, Santilli over gilded the lily, okay? He went that bit too far. Oh, yes, the cameraman, you know, he had polio as a child. Well, that's a great story, but as soon as we find out who he is, he needs to have polio as a child on his record, right? Oh, and he filmed the atomic tests at White Sands. Now, again, it's very specific. Yeah. And if this guy that we find, if he found a military person who he could slip into this position, I think he probably did, by the way. The problem he's got now is that none of these things fit this guy because it's very personal elements.
Yep.
So, so the story was all Santilli's. I wrote a backstory about who the alien is. Because when you create an alien, you need to, for example, you need to know who this person is, where do they come from, how do they tick, what do they eat. You know, how long do they live? Are they born? Are they sexual? Are they all these things are important because you can't build it unless you know how it ticks.
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to cut it open and you're going to show the machinery.
Yep.
You're going to see the mechanics and you're going to say, this is how it works. Well, if you don't know what you're going to make it, either make it like a human being, in which case it blows it because it could be a deformed human. Mm. So it needs to be very different inside. So I wrote the backstory to what the creature's going to be and who it is. But Ray and his team in the office wrote the story about the cameraman and how he acquired the film.
Mm.
Now, very, very soon, people started getting agitated because they wanted an interview with the cameraman. And he said, well, he doesn't want to talk to anybody. He's broken the law. He doesn't want people to think that he's a traitor to his country because he loves America, right? And he doesn't want to be seen as a traitor.
Yep.
And he'll be outcast in his society, in his community, blah blah blah. And so he won't speak to anybody. And I think it was Fox that said. I think it may have been Bob Kiviat, or it may have been one of the guys at in Hong Kong. Who said, why can't we have an interview with him in a silhouette?
Yeah.
Right? So he doesn't have to be named, but he can answer some questions.
Mm.
So suddenly I get a phone call from Santilli and he said, I've got a problem. I need to deliver. Because, by the way, we couldn't make the Tada moment. We couldn't make the documentary to say this is how we made it until Volker Spielberg had recouped his money.
Yeah.
And they were going to get that money via photographs on a newspaper and a magazine who wanted to do the story.
Mm.
So they wouldn't sell the story as in, here's the film, buy it, it's real.
Yep.
The papers were happy to pay for a picture of an alien and say, look, this might be an alien.
Yep.
Okay. And that's how they're going to get the money back. But what he was telling us was nobody wants to pay, nobody believes it, and we need to give it another level of substance that they can build on. So I said to Ray, well, I can film a cameraman's interview. And he said, well, we'll never get away with it, and how would you do that? And you know, I said, well, we'll go to Los Angeles, we'll find a bum in the street living rough.
Yep.
We'll offer him some money and a night in a hotel in return for an interview. We'll tell him we're making a student film. He won't know what it's about because nowhere will we mention aliens within the interview.
Yeah.
Okay, so it won't be any aliens involved. So he won't have even a clue what this is about.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to put him back where we found him because we're getting $500 and we said, look, we've got the room to film in and you can stay the night,
yep.
get some room service, have a bath, do whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
And off he went, right? So he would then be living rough again.
Yeah.
He'd be 80 years old or so, because we wanted an old guy, you know.
Yeah.
How long will he last?
Yeah.
You know, as callous as that sounds,
mm.
It's a case of, okay, he hasn't got a TV set. He can't have any family, otherwise he wouldn't be sleeping rough.
Yep.
And for a moment in his time, we've given him some money to buy food, we've looked after him, we've given him a room and left, gone on our way. And he's not likely to see it on TV when it comes out because he hasn't got a TV.
Yep.
That's the best I could do, the best I could come up with to safeguard us being blown out of the water at some point.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. He was, we don't know where he is now. I think I did find an old guy. Gary Shewfield was very, very conscious of the fact that we mustn't fly together to Los Angeles. So there would be a paper trail.
Yes.
So I flew into LA on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary flew into New York. And then he got a connecting flight, an internal flight from New York.
Mm.
So whilst in LA, we met up with a friend of Gary's who's called Ray Levy. Now, Ray Levy later played the part of the cameraman's son.
Yeah.
And he delivered tape to Bob Kiviat at Fox.
Yeah.
So that was a guy called Ray Levy. And he was around.
Mm.
So we found Gary and I drove around and we first of all went to an electronic shop and we bought a NTSC American Standard camcorder, VHS camcorder. And the reason for that is because if anyone was to do any tests on the film we deliver, they would be able to tell whether or not this was on American Standard video,
yep.
and converted, because we would get caught out, you see.
So
obviously this has been filmed from an English camcorder in PAL. The system's called PAL.
So
I was meticulous. So I bought an American camcorder to film the interview, and Santilli supplied the script. There was questions and answers.
Yeah.
So I made up the gentleman that we found. His name was Moose Coulson.
Yeah.
And he happened to be an actor, an ex-actor. Who would have thought, right?
Yeah.
so you know, you'd find an ex-actor living rough in the streets of Hollywood. So
yeah.
So we took him back to the motel and I made him up, gave him a shave. And I put a few bits of prosthetics on him, different nose and some glasses and a hat. And I said to him, nobody knew who he was, by the way. We didn't ask his name or anything until I got rid of Sue Shewfield. I said to him, Gary, do me a favor. Why don't you two go off and get some coffees whilst I get our actor ready?
Yeah.
And we told him it's a student film. So that it wouldn't raise any eyebrows. It wouldn't be like, what's it for? What's it, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a student film. It's a piece of nothing. It's, you know, you're going to play a military guy and it's just a bit of fun.
Mm.
So I said to him, look, you don't have to memorize the lines because you could just say, I've written down the answers because I'm a little bit nervous. So I don't want to forget anything. And I will use my glasses because I can't see very well. And, right, so basically, you're wearing glasses. You can read from the paper sporadically, and there's no, you've excused yourself. No one's thinking this guy doesn't know what he's talking about because these are notes that you've written before.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you're going to tell them that your son's filming this.
Yeah.
Your son's behind the camera and he's filming this, and you didn't want to do this interview, but because, you know, you love your country and United States is the greatest country in the world. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 you know. So that's exactly what we did. So I put a big light behind him. And the idea was to reduce the brightness and contrast in the edit.
Mm.
And I knew full well that somebody could then return that up. on a TV or in another edit suite, and they can see the cameraman brighter and clearer, and they will think that somehow they've become clever and they've done something clever.
Yeah,
but actually they're still not looking at the guy because I've put a different nose on him, what I did was he had a very unusual voice, which is very high pitched and New York. It was kind of a New York accent. And so what I did was I slowed the voice down so that it was a bit deeper.
Yeah.
But the afflictions were exactly the same. You could tell, you know, if you know who the guy is, you can tell it's him. And when I came back, when Gary went off to get the coffee, I started asking him personal questions. You know, so how have you found yourself in this situation? Are you in good health? Are you okay? Do you need any help that way? No, I'm fine, you know. And so what films have you been in? And he told me a couple of films he was in, so I wrote them down. And I wrote his name. I said, I'll check them out. I'll check, you know. So I was just being friendly.
Yeah.
But when we got back, I started looking for the films, trying to find the films. And I did find one of the films. It's a comedy called Can I Do It Till I Need Glasses? and it's exactly as it sounds.
I can imagine.
Right? It was lots of scantily clad women and lots of very, very chauvinistic jokes. Yeah. And it was that kind of movie. And I found the piece with him in it. And I've since shown it at talks that I do. If I do a theatre talk or whatever, I've shown it. And revealed who it is, and it's without question that, you know, one of the researchers in the UFO community have actually contacted a friend of Moose Carlson who has confirmed that it's him.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm the only one that ever knew who he was, because Shufield didn't know who he was, although he was there.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Anton Deck movie?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
And when I saw it, I thought this. I mean, it obviously had a brief moment. I think, was it 2006 that it was released?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So it struck me at the time when I saw it, and it even more so now, Spiros, that it was a very romanticised version of true events, shall we say.
Well, I call it the Gary and Ray show. Okay. They had nothing to do with a lot of it.
Yeah.
And it's all about Gary and Ray. And there is a scene where Gary and Ray drive around Hollywood looking for an old boy to film. Well, that was me and Gary.
Yeah.
Ray wasn't even there, you know. So they basically cut us all out, you know. And be that as it may, I did film the cameraman's interview, and all the script that he answered was from Ray. And I was very impressed that they did that amount of research and managed to find things like... officers' nicknames. You know, General Ramey was called Tui or whatever it was. I can't remember now.
Yeah.
But, you know, how would you know that unless you were there?
Yeah.
Okay. And that bothered me for quite a long time. How did Santilli get that information? And I went with it for a while. And then the penny dropped because a couple of other things happened. And Santilli gave a number of people a drawing of the crash site, a map of the, a map drawing of the crash site where the UFO had crashed.
Yep.
So I thought to myself, okay, and I was talking to these people, and they're saying, you wasn't involved, you don't even know about where the crash site was, and Ray has that information. He clearly has spoken to a cameraman, and the cameraman is real because there's too much information.
Yeah.
And I thought, what a great move on his part, you know. What a fantastic move. But then I thought to myself, well, you know what? There's no telling that this person that he's talking to is a cameraman at all.
Yeah.
Right? It can be any of the military personnel that were there in 1947 because something did crash. Right? So all you've got to do is advertise for someone who was there and offer them money to interview them. And they would say, oh, yeah, we were all shipped out to this place and we did this. And then when we got there, there was pieces of the craft everywhere. It could have been a Russian spy plane. It could have been a you know, a prototype plane that crashed and they didn't want anyone to know about it.
Yeah.
Especially the Russians, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it could have been anything. So the interview only had to be changed ever so slightly.
Mm.
So all that information is really good information. And then all you had to do is stick in there, oh, yeah, the freaks were lying there holding their boxes. Mm. Well, the boxes were my idea.
Yeah.
Okay, so I know that was inserted into the narrative.
Yeah.
Okay, so because they wouldn't have been holding their boxes, that's a complete fictional thing. Mm. Yeah. I know I came up with that. I made the boxes. I made the control panels.
Mm.
So we said we mustn't call them aliens. So he called them freaks.
Mm.
Okay, so it could be anything. So over the years, I'm now quite comfortable with the idea that Santilli did actually meet a military person who attended a crash.
Yep.
That's why there is a crash site. That's why he could give us a map. That's why that map was given to a couple of people. I think Philip Mantle went with Ed German.
Yep.
And they followed the map and went to a crash site and they found burnt foliage and trees and, you know, something had crashed there. And the detail of the map, you know, it described things like a dried up creek and, you know, a little bridge and this and that. So clearly the person had been there and was there.
Mm.
So when you add that to this story, it adds credence to the story because of all the other stuff. But when you call him the cameraman, it takes on a different life, doesn't it?
Mm. I mean, I think, to be fair as well, it wasn't really a secret at that time because obviously thanks to Stanton Friedman, Roswell had basically been forgotten till sort of the mid-70s. So by the point that this film is ongoing, as I referred to at the beginning, Spiros, you know,
yes.
UFOs were everywhere, the X-Files were everywhere, and it was, you know, Chris Carter was using a lot of UFO mythology for templates for episodes, including Roswell.
Yes.
So it was very, and especially in America, obviously the market was extremely thirsty for that kind of information, and the, you know, people were buying back into it probably to an extent that they hadn't seen since probably the late 50s when we had people like Adamski and the like, who, you know, the contactee movement and such.
Absolutely.
So at that point, for me, I wouldn't be surprised if someone would come forward, because the first thing they would think is, everybody wants to hear about UFOs. I worked at that area at the time. I can make a bit of cash here. I'll tell these people whatever they want to hear.
That's right. But there's a few of those because I explained to you, I made a Bokus documentary.
Mm.
And I also went to Roswell.
Mm.
And I took my crew. And we filmed everyone and anyone that we could find who was there. And they didn't know that I'd made the alien autopsy.
Yep.
I'm behind the camera and I'm asking them questions. And I met my fair share of people who had told me they saw my image in 1947. Yep, that's what we saw.
Hmm.
And I didn't want to argue with them at the time because I wanted to make this documentary.
Yeah.
But my conversation, my questions would have been very clear. Had I been making, you know, a documentary about how this is a fake, I would simply say to them, well, why did you say you saw three fingers and a thumb and not six fingers? You're on record. Why did you say they were really thin and they had little spindly legs and little spindly necks? And, you know, why didn't you say that? Why are you saying this is the same when this is absolutely different from what you described?
Yeah.
But I didn't do that. You know, because it didn't suit the narrative in terms of what I was trying to make. I wanted to make a documentary that said it's real, without me saying it.
Hmm.
So the interesting thing that I found was there were people coming forward saying, like a person called Sergeant Clifford Stone.
Hmm.
He told me that he saw this film in 1969 in a military establishment. And I said, was it the same? Because it might, you know what? I'm the most fair person in an argument ever.
Yeah.
If if you say to me, I've seen an alien, I'm not going to tell you you're mental. I'm not going to tell you you're cuckoo. I'm not going to say you're lying. I'm going to say, you know what? Maybe he did. Mm. Right? I don't know. If I know, I will tell you what I know. But if I don't know, I'm the first person to say, you know, I don't know. Mm. Now, I asked him point blank, is it the same creature? And he said, identical. And then he repeated that again after a pause and said, identical, as if to reinforce that.
Yeah.
Now, I know he's lying.
Yeah.
Because every aspect of that creature I invented.
Yeah.
And John and I sat in Fabrizio's cafe in Finchley Road, and we deliberated over every tiny little thing. Should it have a distended belly? Because if it's got two stomachs, it's creating gas, it's creating bacteria and feeding the second stomach when it's hibernating in space, traveling hundreds of thousands of light years away, right? Mm. So if the body now dies and it's not using up this bacteria that the first stomach is creating, it will start to blow out because it's blowing it up because the bacteria won't die. The bacteria is alive still.
Mm.
Okay, and it just carries on distending until it looks like it's pregnant.
Mm.
And that suited us because we made it female.
Mm.
Female looking. Okay, so everything was carefully, carefully thought of. So when this guy says to me, it's identical, well, I'm sorry, you're lying.
Yeah.
Right? If you say, well, you know what, it looks similar, but the feet were different and the legs were a bit thinner, and you know, maybe he saw something else. So I gave him the benefit of the doubt, and he hung himself with enough rope. He hung himself.
Yeah.
So I knew he was lying. Other people, like, for example, a guy called Lieutenant Robert Shirky.
Yeah.
He said to me, I don't think this is real.
Mm.
And I said, why did you say that? And he said, well, it doesn't look right to me.
Mm.
And I said, can you give me some specifics? He said, well, they're wearing these suits, and he said, supposedly protecting them from the outside forces and germs and whatever they might be afraid of. And he said, and they have no method of breathing. They have no air supply to the suit. So I'm quick on my feet. You know, I'm thinking quick on my feet, and I stopped filming. And I said to him, let me explain to you what we think situation is, and we showed him the film again. And I deliberately didn't film any of the feet. And it wasn't because I already thought of this. I'm going to be absolutely honest with you, I didn't think of it. But I couldn't make any boots. They were difficult. They were difficult to make. I didn't want them wearing shoes. They had to be part of the suit, and to make the suit look real, it had to be a solid boot. And I just couldn't make it. So what I did was I made the legs fit into a foot, into a sock, if you like.
Yeah.
A bit of a onesie.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but it looked very flimsy. It didn't look like it would be a genuine thing. So I just thought, you know what? I just won't film the feet.
Yeah.
Okay. So I thought, okay, when he said to me there's no supply, air supply, I just off camera said to him, is it possible that they're being fed air via a pipe, a tube attached to the boot? And he said, well, that is possible.
Mm.
And I said to him, because that's probably what, you know, otherwise they can't breathe, right? Well, when we were filming, they couldn't breathe. Right. It's a fact.
Yeah.
My partner at the time, Greg Simmons, he was my business partner, and he was going to be the assistant to John Humphreys, who was playing the surgeon.
Mm.
And we filmed two autopsies. So the first one wasn't correct.
Yeah.
So we filmed the first one, but Greg was the assistant in the first one.
Yeah.
And he couldn't breathe, and he's got asthma and all sorts, you know. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't do this. I just can't do it. I'm going to faint. So my girlfriend, who was the researcher on the project, who wasn't ever supposed to be in the film, she was standing, and I said, look, you've got to put the suit on and get on with it, because we've got to get it done. And she put Greg's suit on, and she was the nurse.
Yeah.
And that's how that happened. So, again, they couldn't breathe. So I cut holes into the top of the helmets with a Stanley knife.
Yeah.
So the wrist just slits, so they could get some air in and out. Although it wasn't a long time in there because every roll lasted about 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
So they would go into the suit with a deep breath, hold their breath, and get on with what I was telling them to film. I was shouting orders at them.
Yeah.
And then when they breathe out, they could still breathe in, but it would be very hot in there and it would be uncomfortable. But 3.5 minutes was doable.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. Every 3.5 minutes, they would take the thing off and gasp like goldfish out of a bowl. And it was quite comical to see. And I wish I filmed it, you know, because today it was fantastic. But I now say to people that say to me it's real, I say, well, I've just told you, I've cut holes into the heads of the suits. All you have to do is watch the film again now and look at nothing else but the top of their heads.
Yeah.
And you'll see the suits going up and down. Now, if they were suits that were protecting them from radiation and from outside germs and whatever, viruses and whatever might be there, these suits would be pressurized. They would have air inside and no air from the outside would come in.
Hmm.
Only air would come out. So it wouldn't go in and out, up and down. It would just go out and stay pressurized.
Hmm.
So that shows you, it tells you it's fake, yeah. Just that alone. And the fact that you won't find any of these suits anywhere in history.
Yeah.
they don't exist anywhere else. We made them. You know, I designed them to be in this film to look like they're right, but they weren't right. There was lots of faults. So Clifford Stone was telling me that it's real. And then I met this guy that told me it wasn't real because of the air supply. And off camera, I said to him, yes, we're told that there was an air supply to the boot. And he said, well, that would make sense. So we turned the camera on again. And then he just said, well, I've just seen the film again and I've had the explanations that go along with it. And I have to say that I'm not really sure and it could be real. So he turned, because the only negativity that he had, the only negative point was no air feed to the suit. Once that was explained, he had nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
So,
it shows as well, Spiros, that at that point in time, there were a lot of people who were desperately trying to get involved. I mean, it's a prime example of the Mandela effect, where people are absolutely convinced that they've seen something or they know something, you know, such as a famous celebrity dies and people are convinced that they died years ago.
Yes.
And especially in the social media age, it must happen once a month, I'll see something on Twitter or Facebook where someone who's been dead for ages.
Yeah.
Someone finds that they found somebody who clearly wasn't aware that they'd passed away, shares the story, and then all of a sudden they're dead again. And you're just like, hang on. How many times do we have to keep reliving the same events?
Yes, 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 absolutely.
And it seems that you could apply that to these people who were so desperate, you know, as you referred to the chap who said, oh, yeah, I definitely saw that in 1969.
Yeah, yeah.
Knowing full well that he couldn't possibly have seen the video that you had because it had only just been made.
That's right. It was, yeah. The other thing that once you scratch the surface, everyone has their own story.
Mm.
Everyone has an agenda. Mm. You know, they're fueled by their own story.
Mm.
So when I scratched the surface with Clifford Stone, I found out that he was put in a mental institution.
Yep.
He was humiliated. His son died at an early age, a young age.
Mm.
He'd been through a lot of trauma. And because they're in the UFO community and they're conspiracy theorists and all the rest of it, what the story was, well, it wasn't because he was mad that they put him into this hospital. It's because he knew too much.
Yes.
And they silenced him by killing his son. And of course, that I don't believe that's the case. I feel terrible that happened to anybody, you know.
Mm.
And I was so upset that when I heard that, and I dedicated the documentary to his son, you know, in loving memory of his son.
Mm.
But I didn't buy it for a second.
To be fair, Spiros, we know enough about the powers that be, and with the greatest respect, you could apply this to the UK, Russia, China, wherever, as well as America. You know, if someone is of such a loose cannon, and is a danger to certain parts of authority at yeah. that period of time, they would have had no hesitation in executing them, never mind his family.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about, you know, obviously it's all come to light in the recent era, but, you know, we were fully aware that the CIA were, you know, the LSD test that ended up with one guy throwing himself out of a window, poor sod.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, that never stacks up for me when I think about that, because these people had the ways, the means, and the motive to make people disappear at that period of time. Anything could happen. A terrible accident on the airbase, anything.
Yeah, but you know what, though? It's not just that period of time.
Oh, no. Yes.
Now, Colin Wolford, who we all know and love, maintains that this is a real film.
Yeah.
He maintains that I'm being paid by government bodies. I'm an agent.
Disinformation.
Which I think is fantastic. I love being an agent. I've got a license to, I don't know what to do, a license to drive my car. That's pretty much it. But if we go along the Wolford story, I'm a secret agent and I'm perpetuating a lie to cover the truth, which is that the alien is real and blah, 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 blah. Now, I said to him, if that was true, they would get rid of you in a heartbeat. You would be history. And he said, oh, they wouldn't be able to now because it would look a bit suspicious, wouldn't it? All of a sudden, I've vanished. Right? This is how silly he is. And I said to him, really, they're not that stupid. They're much cleverer than that. You know, you could go to a restaurant and get food poisoning and you're gone.
Yep.
Right? You could have a car accident. You could be run over. You could, a number of things can happen. There could be a gas leak in your house and you die in your sleep. It won't have to be as sinister as you think it is in terms of, oh, he's vanished. They're not that stupid.
Yeah.
If they were real, right? But I promise you, nobody cares about you. Nobody gives two hoots.
So, I mean, Spiros, when did he turn up perpetuating the rebirth of this nonsense?
You know what? I can't remember now. It must be at least a couple of 3 years now that I've had to tolerate the nonsense.
Yeah.
And I've been very polite and very kind, and then he's been very nasty. And it got to a point where I just thought, do you know what? Gloves are off. I don't care anymore. I don't care anymore. He perpetuated all sorts of stories about me. I mean, he was telling people I was bankrupt. He was telling people I've been to prison. Mm. He was telling people that I'm a porn lord. Mm. A gazillion things, right? And at the end of it all, I was saying to him, look, Mr. Wolford, I'm not bankrupt. I've never been bankrupt.
Yep.
I've got credit cards. I've got overdrafts. I've got bank accounts. I'm a director of companies. You can't do that stuff if you're a bankrupt.
Mm.
Yeah, well, you're doing it legally. And I said, you know what? What you're doing is you're painting a very bad picture. And I'm going to go to the official receiver. And I'm going to say, I understand I'm bankrupt. And I went to my bank because this rumor was going on. It was on the internet. It was everywhere.
Mm.
And I had no knowledge of any of it. So I went to my bank and I said, I just wanted to let you know there's this thing going around that I'm a bankrupt. I'm not. I don't know anything about it. I want you to be fully aware of it so you can do your own due diligence so you're not going to hear it from anyone else.
Mm.
I did that systematically to everybody I was working with, the BBC, everybody.
Hmm.
And I also went to the official receiver and I said, is there a file on me? Am I bankrupt? I haven't been served. I don't know anything about this.
Yep.
They couldn't find the file, but by this time they got their teeth into it. And they said, one department didn't know what the other department was doing. And I received a letter which said I had to resign as a director of the companies because I couldn't be a director as a bankrupt. And I said, but I'm not a bankrupt. Well, we've got a note here that you are and you have to resign. And I said, well, I'm not going to resign. And they said, well, in that case, we're going to have to force you to resign. So they took me to court.
Mm.
And I won. So that's the story. Right. Yeah. This is how ridiculous it went.
Well, I mean, it is a very strange thing, and going on a slight tangent, Spiros.
Yes.
One of, I met some very interesting characters in the early 90s, one of whom was a porn baron.
I love that phrase, a porn baron.
So I worked for this gentleman for a couple of years. He's no longer with us.
Yeah.
And to say, I met most of the movers and shakers. I didn't work in that capacity, I hasten to add, either behind or in front of any camera. But I was a public landlord. I ran pubs for... he basically bought a couple of pubs in Sheffield.
Yeah.
And I ended up running them for him.
Okay.
But he would often have everybody and anybody from the Dutch, the German, the English... even the Italian porn industries, which I didn't even know, from places I didn't even know they had a porn industry.
Yeah.
They would often come. I met near enough anybody who was anybody in the British porn scene. I never heard your name mentioned once.
No.
Disappointingly.
I'll tell you where that came from. I ran a very large TV studio in White City, which is literally across the road from the BBC. And in fact, it was one of the largest independent TV studios and broadcast facilities in the UK.
Mm.
Big place.
Yeah.
And in the daytime, we would facilitate things like CBeebies and Nickelodeon and Sky TV, ITV, Channel 4 would all be making programs there, BBC.
Mm.
And at night, the studio was empty and the rates were stupid money.
Mm.
So my partner and girlfriend at the time said, why don't we hire the studio out at a lower rate in the evenings?
Mm.
And I said, well, who's going to want to work in the evenings, you know, the early hours of the morning and stuff? And lo and behold, she found a telephone company who did these chat lines.
Yeah.
So they came along and they said, OK, well, we'll take it from 9 p.m. at night until 6 a.m. in the morning.
Mm.
And that was perfect because they would broadcast live from the studio. So there would be half-naked girls on beds taking phone calls from people that are watching TV on Sky. And right, so that's where the porn thing came from. They weren't my channels. I had nothing to do with them. Yes, I oversaw the functionality of the studio. So if they needed a set built, if they needed whatever, you know, because they had different sets and what have you, we did all that for them. Mm. But they weren't my channels. They weren't my gig.
Yep.
Then what happened was the telephone company left.
Yep.
And all of a sudden there's a few channels that are sitting there, and one of a couple of people that I know bought the channels and carried on running them. Mm. They owned them and we carried on running them.
Yeah.
So that's where it came from. So half true.
I mean, with, you know, with the greatest of respect, you know,
I know.
We're talking of titillation.
I know.
You know, it's just.
But from these scenarios, great jokes come.
Mm.
Okay. Because I coined the phrase, because you know CBeebies, you know the. And I said, because I didn't want the BBC to not know that we did that at night time, because it would be terrible if they didn't know and they thought they were being hoodwinked, you know.
Yeah,
so I said, yeah, it's okay, because we see BBs in the daytime and see boobies at night time. And it's not the best joke in the world, but it's funny, isn't it?
Hey, I'm not going to hold you to any standards. Some of my jokes are atrocious. So... why? I mean, this is the thing that has caused me incredible consternation over the last few weeks, and I've tried to get my head around what's going on. Why do you think that Colin Wolford has decided that this is all real and we are now re-perpetuating this nonsense? Is it for financial gain, or is it just a case of hoodwinking people, or what?
No. Colin, I don't believe Colin is in it for the money.
Yeah.
I don't believe Colin is a con man. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I said to you at the beginning of this interview, I said to you, I will tell you how it is, and I don't make stuff up, right? Yeah. I won't say, oh, he's this and he's that, because he said a lot of things about me. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you his good points, okay? His good points are he's a normal bloke. He's got a job. I think he works for British Airways.
Mm.
He's got a job. He holds down a job. He has a hobby, which is the UFO scene.
Yep.
And that's pretty much his life, okay? So I don't blame him for wanting to be special.
Yeah.
You know, that's the bottom line. I don't think he's a con man. I don't think he's gaining any financial gain. He's got nothing to sell. You know, he does talks in pubs for £5, a pop. So he's clearly not in it for the money. He's in it for the notoriety.
Yeah.
Okay. It makes him somebody in a field where he would be nobody if he didn't toe this line.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think he deliberately set out to become somebody, but I think he does want to be respected. He wants to be somebody in the community.
Hmm.
So that's Colin for you. Okay. Now, his weakness is that he believes there's no smoke without fire.
Yeah.
It's a good saying. It's a good saying, but you've got to say, you know what, the fire's been put out. And it's not smoke anymore. It's somebody blowing smoke in your face.
Yeah.
You've got to understand when somebody's stopped, when the reality's stopped and the fake carries on.
Mm.
Now, he's spoken to Santilli. Not met him. I don't know if they actually met him in person. But he's basically been told, okay, I'm going to come clean. The fake, a lot of the film was recreated.
Yeah.
Santilli calls it a restoration.
But that's not a recreation. They're completely different things.
Absolutely. It's a wrong... Listen, the word's wrong.
I misspoke.
And he's using it in to suit him.
Yeah.
You know, oh, yeah, you know, we, if you restore an old painting, somebody paints on top of it. So it's not actually the painting, but it's still the original painting. No, this is nothing like it. This is a film that never existed, and it's been filmed again, right? So it's a recreation at best.
Yes.
Okay.
At best.
So, yeah. But he uses that. That's what. But then Colin takes that and thinks, so then maybe it was real film, because I want to believe it's real.
Mm.
And if we go down that road and we say, okay, there was real film, I can still be a player in this.
Mm.
Okay. And the conspiracy idea fitted. Now, here's what the problem is. In terms of who I am in the sphere of show business, I'm not anyone that you might have heard of.
Yep.
Because I'm not Spielberg and I'm not George Lucas and I'm not... Doesn't mean to say I haven't got the skills.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean to say that I just haven't done it commercially anywhere before that. And... What people don't realise is I played host to every broadcaster pretty much everywhere in my studio. I mean, that's a tall order, right?
Yeah.
Right. BBC lived in my studio, okay? Channel 4 in my studio, Sky TV and all the various channels on Sky TV, including Sky itself, Sky One and News and, right? We used to do the general elections with Peter Snow in my studio.
Mm.
Okay, with a swingometer.
Yeah.
We did Strictly Come Dancing. We did Ali G. We did, I mean, big stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was rubbing shoulders with all the top executives. My name didn't appear on any of those programs because they weren't my programs.
Mm.
We were facilitating. We were making them happen.
Yeah.
And BBC made them. Or we would make them happen and somebody else made. So they think, well, where did Spiros come from? All of a sudden, he's just come out of nowhere. Well, my partner, John Humphreys, was working in a company called Coast to Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And Coast to Coast was a special effects company.
Yep.
And John, not being a special effects man per se, he was he's a sculptor.
Yeah.
But he learnt the ropes because he was working with other special effects experts, making animatronics, making models of things, making... Right, so that were being used in major movies.
Yeah.
So John's name wasn't known. So Colin found it hard to understand how this very amazing team, I'm not blowing my own trumpet because I'm going to put myself to the side for the time being, but John is spectacularly amazing.
Yeah.
I can't say that enough. Okay. He's one of the top sculptors in the world today. He is a lecturer at the Royal Academy.
Yeah.
He's groundbreaking. Seriously. I'm not just saying this stuff. He is amazing. To have John at that time was unbelievably lucky for me.
Yeah.
My girlfriend at the time is the most meticulous researcher anyone could ever meet, and she's not a researcher, she's just super intelligent.
Yeah.
And she did unbelievable work doing that, but she also was a seamstress, she liked to make clothes, and so the funny thing is, my mum had a dressmaking factory when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I used to go there on the weekends and help on holidays and help the cutter in the dressmaking factory. What that guy does, he lays out the material on a big table, and the pattern would be positioned in such a way to get the most out of any roll of material.
Yeah,
so to be the least waste. So he'd be putting a jigsaw puzzle of pattern all over, you know, and that was his expertise. So what he would do, for example, Harrods would commission 500 dresses, and they would provide the material to make 500 dresses.
Yeah.
What this cutter would do is he would maneuver the material around so that he would get the maximum amount and might end up with 550 dresses.
Yeah.
The 50 dresses that were left over wouldn't have labels, although they were Harrods dresses.
Mm.
They wouldn't have labels, and they were called cabbage.
Yeah.
And it was the bunts that the factory could sell as a sideline.
Yep.
And they would sell them privately, and there wouldn't be a Harrods label on, but they'd be identical, and they would pay half the price, and that would be, you know. So that's the value of a good cutter.
Yeah.
So I used to be with him, and he would just show me how he did his job. It was fantastic. But I learned how to cut a pattern, how to draw a pattern, how to work it. So when we did the suits, I drew the pattern, I gave it to my ex, she laid out the cloth, stitched it together. So we both had an expertise in that little area. I've been making movies since I was 6-7 years old. I had a cine camera my dad bought me from a very young age, and I was making movies very early on, and not on video, on film. So I was very familiar with shooting film, which this had to be. So lots and lots of expertises came into play. I'm a qualified motor mechanic, and I was working and ran my own garage until I was about 24, 25. And between that time, I was working as a self-employed freelancer making pop promos. So I was making movies and running a motor repair business at the same time. So I have a very good grasp of mechanics and how to make things.
Yeah.
How to, you know, weld. I could weld, pop rivet, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So when I had to make an alien autopsy table, all right, I made it. I'd ordered a big sheet of metal and bang, 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 and next thing you know, John said I was like the drummer out of the Muppets. What was it called?
Animal.
Animal. he looked around the... He said, he looked around the corner and he saw Animal making this thing, you know. And the pair of them, my ex-girlfriend and John, basically left me to it, thinking I completely lost it.
Yeah.
And they couldn't actually see what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
When they came back, there's a table, you know, there's a metal table, and. And again, I challenge people that don't believe it's real, that don't believe it's fake, to just find another autopsy table like that one, because it's a one-off. I made it to my design. And amazingly, no one's ever said, we don't know where this table comes from. We've never seen one like that.
Yeah.
Because it looks like it should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and people left it alone. But when I say to you, you've got all the tools in the world now with the internet to find me another table like that in the history of mankind, in a hospital, in an installation somewhere, there must exist somewhere if it was real. It doesn't.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, after everything that's gone on over the last few months, Spiros.
Yeah.
right now, what's next for you? What happens next now?
Well, I've been working on one-man shows for quite a while, one night only, AAA A-listers in West End shows, theatres.
Hmm.
And we've met a lot of agents, and one agent was speaking to my partner at the time, and he said, "Don't worry, send us over the photos, and Spiros will knock up a poster."
Hmm.
And she said, "Oh, Spiros, is it a Greek guy?" "Yeah, yeah, Greek. It's not the alien guy, is it?" And he said, "Well, as it happens, yes, it is." And she said, "My boys would love to speak to him." So I got a phone call, and he said, "You know what, I've been to this agent, her boys want to meet you."
Mm.
And I said that I'd organise it. "Is that okay?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "Well, she's organising a conference call." I think her boys, I'm thinking they're like 16-year-old, you know. "A conference call, you know, from America. Okay, well, I'll just go with it, you know."
Yeah.
So next thing you know, I'm on a conference call, and there's two guys that look like ZZ Top. Right? They've got the beards, the whole thing, the tattoos.
Yeah.
Right? And they're called the Diamond Brothers.
Right.
And they told me that they're so excited to talk to me, and the only reason they got into the business that they're in, which is special effects, is because they were scared by the alien autopsy when they found out it was a special effect that inspired them to become who they are.
Right.
And these guys work with George Lucas on Star Wars.
Mm.
So these are big shots.
Yeah.
And they're lovely, the loveliest guys in the world.
Mm.
So I've been talking to another, I can't mention the name, but I've been talking to a very big director, producer in LA,
mm-hmm.
who also wants to make a movie.
Mm.
And these guys said, "We know you're talking to Mr. So-and-so, but please talk to us." And I said, "Well, I can't bypass him. I wouldn't do that."
Mm.
And they said, no, George knows him very well. And we will bring him in to make sure that we're all a team."
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, I'm over the moon. You can imagine.
Mm.
So I've got two of the biggest names in Hollywood want to do a movie with me. Great, you know. And the Diamond Brothers. So I've checked them out. They're amazing. And we've had a few meetings over Skype, and we're scheduling a meeting now to make a movie. So we're going to make a proper movie of the story. Not an Anton Deck thing. It's not going to be a bubblegum movie. It's going to be a black comedy.
Yep.
With proper actors, with with the script exactly as it happened from the horse's mouth.
Yep.
All the people that were involved doing what they did. Ray Santilli had a very, very small part in the making of the film.
Yes.
And when I say small, I mean non-existent.
Yeah. Well, he was just the facilitator for the hype, wasn't he?
Well, you know what? He took the film, sold it. He was a salesman.
Yeah.
And he did a few things wrong.
Mm.
And I'm glad that he didn't tell me he was doing them, because I would have been involved if I went with it. And I wouldn't have done it if I didn't. And it was kind of a problem.
Yeah.
But he didn't tell me what he was doing, and I had no knowledge of it. So I never spoke to anybody. I never sold it to anybody. I've never represented it to anybody other than within my making of it.
Yeah.
So, and it was with every intention to say, it isn't real. Here's how we made it.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm going next with it.
Yeah.
So we're looking at making this movie. I'm very particular with regards to how it's done and who works with me on it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the boys asked me, the Diamond Brothers asked me if I wanted to direct it. And I said, with all due respect, I could direct it, but I don't want it to be me.
Mm.
I'd rather have another director. And there's a number of directors out there that could do this justice.
Mm.
And I want their take on it. And I'm too close. However, I will direct the remake scenes of the autopsy.
Right.
So I'm going to direct, I'm going to shoot that in England, and literally going to recreate it as it is, exactly how we did it, and direct it here with the actors. And because no one can do that better than me.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying that, you know, listen, great directors, as I say, there's some great directors out there and they would all do a great job, but they would miss things because they weren't there.
Yeah, of course. You
know? So I want to make it religiously, you know, as religiously accurate as possible. And by default, what that will do is it will have me recreating it.
Yeah.
And it will silence the Colin Wolfords of this world because they will see that here it is again, you know, well, exactly the thing.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing, you know, and with the greatest respect, Spiros, the one thing that completely convinced me that everything you've said is down the line, and I don't dispute anything you've said,
yeah,
is the fact that I have seen the picture of you with Philip Mantel and Ray Santilli having a Chinese, that you are all sat there together. So, now, that isn't, you know, it looks like it was taken in the mid-90s, because we all have a certain look about us about 94, 95, Spiros. Yeah.
We all had hair.
Yeah, even I had hair back then as well. But
I must correct you. It wasn't Philip Mantel. It was it was me, Ray Santilli, and John Humphreys.
Ah, my apologies. I thought it was Philip. Sorry.
No, Philip has a picture with them.
Yes.
But yeah, it wasn't with Philip. I actually went to Philip when I was making my spoof documentary. Mm. I actually went to Philip's house and interviewed him, and he had no idea who I was. Mm. And later, we laugh about it now.
Yeah.
But you know, at the time, it was. Can you imagine? You know, the what are those Peter Sellers films? The Pink Panther type thing.
Yeah.
It was a little guy, the ninja kind of.
Oh, Kato.
Kato. Yeah. I felt like a little ninja. You know, like, you know, I was undercover, and in this guy's house, and he had no idea who I really was, but I was going to steal the diamond. You know.
Fantastic. So are you gonna pull all this wonderful eccentric story together in a book as well, Spiros?
Well, you know what? I'm guilty of not pulling my finger out. I haven't touched my book for the last 4 months. I haven't even looked at it. Yes, I'm nearly there. Mm. I'm pleased that I haven't put it to bed yet.
Yeah.
Because all this later stuff would have been it would have been not in the book.
Yeah.
So this whole nonsense with the CIA and, you know, so I can add that now, you see, it's you know, I'm hoping there's not going to be any more surprises. Yes, it's very nearly there. I keep getting asked. I'm very embarrassed every time I'm asked because, you know, I've got a very busy life. I do quite a lot in my life, you know, on a daily basis. And I'm not a writer. So for me to sit down and write the book, I need to do nothing else because I can't concentrate. I've got to stop and just do that. Mm. And I keep promising myself that I would do that. And then I get a phone call. Oh, Sylvester Stallone's coming. And we're going to do it. Yeah, great. Okay, we'll do that. And then off I go. Mm. You know, oh, Al Pacino's go. Okay, we'll go do that. So I've got a very lovely life. I'm very blessed. And, you know, and nothing appeals to me about writing a book.
Mm.
Although I've broken the back of it, and I'm kind of getting to a point now where I'm going to get somebody to proofread it and put it to bed. Mm. The foreword is by Philip Mantel.
Yeah,
and I may ask Uri Geller to do a foreword because a lot of people don't know that he's involved, inadvertently involved.
Right.
And I'll explain that for you. I bought a book back in 95, which was about crystals.
Yep.
And it was written by Uri Geller.
Mm.
And he gave you a free crystal on the cover of the book.
Yeah.
And it was blessed and God knows what by him. And it had special powers. And, yes. You know. So I just thought, you know what? This creature is going to hibernate. Cause you can't survive, you know, hundreds of thousands of light years of travel.
Yeah, suspended animation. It's the only way, Spiros.
Yeah. So how are you gonna do that without dying? You know. So you're an alien. How long do you live? 1,000 years? You're not gonna make it. You know. So because nothing within anywhere we can go. There's no life anywhere we can go. So it's much further than that. If these creatures exist and if they're visiting our planet, they are traveling in a way we can't understand.
Yeah.
Okay. Some people say that it's, you know, it's a parallel universe. It might be a dual reality. It might be a, I don't know. It's all made up. You know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a physicist. I'm not any of those things. I'm a fantasist, right? Yeah. I make stories up. So I figured, if this creature could hibernate, and it could live on trickle feed. Okay, so it's just, it doesn't need very much. It just needs to lower everything to nothingness and just tick over, then the heart can stop as well. But what if there was a quartz crystal on the heart and it worked the same way that it works in a watch?
Yeah.
Okay. That little pulse that keeps that watch going.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what if it was a bigger crystal of a different kind that could keep that very steady pulse, right, on the heart?
Absolutely.
All right, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to use Uri's crystal, and then I just thought, how funny would it be? Because this will go worldwide. Uri will see the alien autopsy. He will be sitting at a dinner party someday, and he'll be saying, "Have you seen that alien autopsy?" And not know that, you know, the 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah.
Not know that he's one step away, right? So, and I tickled me. So I actually put the crystal on the heart and I had the surgeon remove it.
Yeah.
And it's in there. If you look at it now, you can actually see, right? He removes the crystal. And I just thought, one day I'm going to meet Uri. I'm going to tell him that crystal is his crystal. And we would have a laugh.
Yeah.
And you know, and it would be. So that's like, there's so much stuff that's in this little film. It's just lots of bits, layers of fun, lots of little bits and layers of. So I don't know whether I'm going to be able to get him to do a little forward. It'd be fun to do that, you know. But it's everything. It's the backstory about who this alien is. Yeah. So it's there's part of this book that's a fictional book.
Yeah.
That tells you the fictional story of how this alien came with his friends, how they flew how the spaceship works, how they survive, how they reproduce. Do they reproduce? See, they're not sexual beings. That's why they don't have belly buttons.
Yeah.
They haven't got a navel. Therefore, they're not born. They're grown. Mm. Okay. So you flip from one body to the other as you wear it out.
Mm.
So the idea that I asked the question: if this was an alien autopsy and this poor creature had died, and there were other ones that were alive. They're superior beings. How come the others haven't come to rescue them?
Yes.
Right? They've got powers. They're not like us. They can do stuff. They have telepathic powers. They have so much technology that they could incinerate us.
Hmm.
Right? And so you dare do this to one of their mates, you know. Why haven't they retaliated? Why hasn't this happened?
Hmm.
Well, it's not because it doesn't matter, because the body is only a suit.
Hmm.
What you're doing is you're doing an autopsy on his three-piece suit.
Yeah.
Right. And he's gone off, or she's gone off to in another body back home.
Huh.
No loss there. Right. So that made sense to me. I thought that's quite cute.
Yeah.
Right. They're not hung up about their bodies like we are.
Hmm.
So so there's a fictional part of the book that tells you the backstory. And then there's a factual part of how I got the team together.
Yeah.
What all their roles were. I did do it in a way where it was a kind of a need to know basis. Everybody that was involved had their part to play, but didn't know anything about anybody else's part.
Mm.
So I'm the only one that knows about every part, because I was involved in the making of the creature. I was involved in making the suits. I was involved in building the set.
Mm.
I was involved in filming it, editing it, and all the rest of it. So I was the kingpin in the middle. And then you had all these little departments shooting off. So you had the research being done over here. I was party to that. With the costume being made, I was party to that. And the other person, of course.
Mm.
So the other person would know all about the costumes if you were to ask them.
Yeah.
But wouldn't know anything about how the creature was made.
Well, precisely. You are the fulcrum that made the whole thing move.
Yeah. So I have all that information. So it was important because. Although I trusted my team implicitly, at the time, 20 grand from the News of the World, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's a big ask to say to somebody, you know what, you know, you have to wait and we might get a payday down the line. Mm. You know, that was a big ask. So I thought, take away that dangling carrot. Let's get rid of that. So if they all have their part to play, they can't, you know, for example, when John Humphreys, after it all happened and when we weren't seeing, basically Santilli wasn't breaking even apparently, and we can't make our documentary and we have to wait. I said that to John and to the others, and John just decided, you know what, I don't believe this guy. And he went to Philip, to Bob Kiviat in America to tell his story. Mm. Because he knew we were being wound. I didn't know, you see. I trusted Santilli, but John was more astute. And he's thought, you know what, we're being wound up here.
Yeah.
And I've done my bit, and that's it. So he went to Kiviat, who made the Fox program, and he said, I'm the guy that made the creature. Mm. And then Kiviat started asking him questions about, you know, the whole thing. And he said, I don't know anything of that. You need to speak to Spiros. Mm. Right? And my name was put out there. In I think it was 1996 or so.
Yeah.
So my name was known, but not my surname, my Christian name, but not my surname. So when I eventually met Philip Mantle and he heard my name, he knew it was me. Mm. So that it came full circle. Yeah. So the book's on the way. I hope it would be worth the wait.
You know. 24 years in the making, Spiros.
Yeah. It's
Like a bottle of fine wine, sir.
Yes, absolutely. But lots have come forward. Lots of things have come forward that wouldn't have been in it if I wrote it, say, 10 years ago.
Yes, very true.
Lots of things that wouldn't have been in it, and the things have come to light that you know, that are out there now. Mm. So I don't regret it. I do apologise to everyone that's asked me and who are waiting for it.
Yep.
But now that I've got the Diamond Brothers breathing down my neck, I'm going to have to pull my act together. So,
hey, well, whatever you decide to do next, my friend, I will wish you the very best of luck in it.
Thank you. That's very nice of you. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have a chat to you today. So I just wanted to say thank you for giving up some time to speak to me, because I appreciate you're a very busy man.
It's a pleasure.
Can anybody keep up to date with what you're up to online, or are you?
Yes, they can.
Where can they find your links and whatever, Spiros?
You can visit me on www.thealienautopsy.com.
Yep.
Or myname.com.
Yep.
SpirosMolaris.com. And on Facebook, I run a little group called The Alien Autopsy Fact Files.
Yep.
And we speak very freely there. People ask me questions.
Yep.
I hide from no one. I answer questions whenever I'm asked. Mm-hmm. If I know, I tell them exactly what's what. If I don't, I say so.
Yeah, absolutely.
and that's how I am. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, to be fair, Spiros, I've seen some of the fallout over the last 3 or 4 months, and I think you've carried yourself with incredible dignity. I've been shocked at some of the things that have been said to you and about you, because as someone that tries to remain impartial, unless I get dragged into something, I'm not really that fussed, to be fair. Obviously, you know, as we both refer to, I've got so much respect for Philip Mantle and everything he's done for the British UFO community over the last 30 years.
Absolutely.
And obviously,
I call Philip UFO royalty.
Yeah, oh, very much so. He's you know, for me, he's up there in this country with Jenny Randalls, who is, for me, are the two prime investigators that we've ever had out of this country. They've tried to do things on a balanced, even keel, which cannot be said about some.
I'll tell you Philip's best quality. Okay, he's a straight shooter.
Yep.
And even when he's wrong, he's the first to say, you know what, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Right, that's a quality you can't put too much emphasis on. How many people out there, like Michael Hesseman, for example, who will not admit he's wrong?
Yeah.
Right. He's wrong. He knows he's wrong. He won't admit it.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people involved in promoting this at the moment that are very wrong. And some of them are serial estate makers going on some of the nonsense they've come out with over the decade about other certain things, but we'll not mention any names because I don't want to promote people like that personally.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
So Spiros, once again, thank you so much again for your time. It's been lovely having a nice conversation. I hope you've enjoyed it too.
Anytime.
I look forward to keeping up to date with what goes on next, and hopefully we will have the opportunity to speak again one day.
Absolutely.
And if I meet you at one of Philip's events one day, I shall buy you a drink, sir, and we can have a good laugh. But
you take
care, and like I say, once again, thank you for your time today, Spiros.
Thank you very much, and good night, everybody. Okay, bye.